Some critics of the war in Iraq have called it another Vietnam, a comparison the Bush administration strongly rejects. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has been thinking about how the Vietnam experience has permeated our language.
On the day of the ceasefire of the first Iraq War in 1991, President George H.W. Bush wrote in his diary, "Vietnam will soon be behind us." Fat chance. 13 years later, the mother of all battles is a trivial pursuit item, while Vietnam is still raw in the national psyche. Hence the indignant reactions last month when Senator Kennedy charged that Iraq had become George Bush's Vietnam. The president called the analogy false and said it sent the wrong message to our troops and to the enemy. And other administration supporters described it as outrageous, hysterical, or defeatist. The charge set off a flurry of comparing and contrasting. Opponents of the war were toting up the numerous similarities between Vietnam and Iraq. Its supporters noted the significant differences. That's always the way it is with these comparisons. History has no end of lessons to teach us if we could only figure out which of them are going to be on the test. But as the heated reactions to Kennedy's charges made clear, calling Iraq another Vietnam isn't an idle exercise in comparative history. It implies that the war is a colossal mistake brought about by American arrogance and hubris. Vietnam is one of those names that have become common nouns like Waterloo, Pearl Harbor, or Munich, words that have seceded from history and entered the language as the names of object lessons. For example, Munich is just shorthand for an elastic fable about the dangers of giving in to an aggressor. The administration invoked it to describe the French and German refusal to back a preemptive attack on Saddam Hussein. Spiro Agnew invoked it in 1968 when Hubert Humphrey suggested withdrawing some troops from Vietnam. Inevitably, fables like those color the other words that touch them. Before 1938, appeasement could simply mean bringing peace. President Roosevelt used the word approvingly to describe Mussolini's 1936 conquest of Ethiopia. But after Munich, appeasement was reduced to an epithet. Vietnam is a much more complicated narrative than Munich, of course, with many more words attached to it. The administration may insist that Iraq doesn't look like Vietnam, but there's no way to keep the two from sounding alike. Some expressions simply conjure up the setting, in country, the facts on the ground, collateral damage. But others are charged with the bitter lessons of that period, even if people don't always hear them right off. Just a couple of weeks after the Iraq War began, Presidential Press Secretary Ari Fleischer reassured the public that slowly but surely the hearts and minds of the Iraqi people are being won. In retrospect, Fleischer's choice of words was overconfident, if not imprudent. Hearts and minds is saturated with unsettling memories that bubble to the surface as resistance to the occupation swelled. Or take the charges that the administration's critics were failing to support the troops. That association recalled Vietnam, too. In earlier wars, supporting the troops was something you did by collecting scrap or buying war bonds. But by the late 60s or early 70s, the irony of the phrase was becoming apparent as people questioned whether support for the war was in the best interest of the people who were fighting it. I remember in 1971 hearing Tom T. Hall's sardonic song, "Mama Bake a Pie," about a legless vet returning home. If country stations were playing that song, I thought, the administration was on its way to losing the hearts and minds of the American people as well. It isn't surprising that a discussion that begins with phrases like hearts and minds and support the troops should call up the word quagmire as the war drags on, even if the jungle metaphor seems a little out of place for a desert locale. And it's predictable that supporters of the war respond with phrases like stay the course. It's as if everybody's reading from the same yellowing libretto. The other day, I was wondering if anybody had used the light at the end of the tunnel in connection with Iraq yet. When I did a Google search, it turned up 15,000 hits. If the language of Vietnam still has a hold on us, it's because the memory of its trauma and divisiveness is still vivid, even if the war itself isn't. By now, a majority of the population has no direct recollection of Vietnam itself. What the name calls to mind isn't the evening news reports from the period, but a pastiche of images from the Green Berets, Coming Home, The Deer Hunter, and Born on the 4th of July. Up to now, the Iraq War hasn't been anywhere near as wrenching a national experience as Vietnam was. It's touched a lot fewer lives and stirred up far less turbulence and dissension. And the war may yet come to a resolution without creating the kind of collective trauma that leaves its marks on the language for generations to come. But if not, Iraq may very well displace Vietnam as a cautionary tale, the same way 9/11 has displaced Pearl Harbor as the name of a devastating surprise attack. The next time we find ourselves contemplating some foreign intervention, people may be warning that it could turn out to be another Iraq. At that point, we really will have put Vietnam behind us, but it's hard to view the prospect as optimistically as the first President Bush did in 1991.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and author of the new book, Going Nuclear.